Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening. Today, many of the world's people face real threats from food shortages, from water scarcity, and also from environmental pollution. And as the world's population continues to grow, we'll confront this question. Will changes in the global environment mean that even more people will find that their health and their well-being are threatened? This morning, in this first hour of the show, we'll be talking about some of the connections between natural resources, human health and security, and changes in the global environment. And our guest for this program is John Foley. He is the director of the Center for Sustainability and the Global Environment at the University of Wisconsin, where he is also the Gaylord Nelson Distinguished Professor of Environmental Studies and Atmospheric and Oceanic Studies. His work takes a look at the behavior of complex global environmental systems and how those systems interact with human society. He's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions from people who are listening are certainly welcome. The only thing that we ask of callers is that people try to be brief so that we can keep our program moving and get in as many different callers as possible. But, of course, anyone listening is invited to join the conversation. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. And we do also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us. 800-222-9455. At any point here, if you have questions, you can call us. Professor Foley, hello.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm fine. Thanks. And yourself?
I'm great.
Well,
thanks for having me here this morning.
I appreciate that you are giving us some of your time. The subject here we're talking about, we're setting out here, the territory is very broad. Now, I'm sure that people, if they have specific kind of areas they'd like to focus on, they can do that with their questions, and I know that you'll do your best to respond.
I
hope people will understand that all questions cannot be answered. We will say that, I'd say that with any program. Starting in the broadest possible terms, I guess, so I think that what we're talking about here is the carrying capacity of the planet. How many people can it support? How much food can be grown? How much water is there? How do we deal with the amount of waste that those people produce? And what's their need for energy? All of those are very big questions. Is there, and I suppose from time to time people have had different answers, is there actually an answer to that question? What if you ask it like this, what is the carrying capacity of the planet? How many people can it support? Is there some way to answer that question?
Well, you know, it's like a lot of things. I think it's a lot more complicated than that. There's no just single number. In many ways, we may have already exceeded quite by a lot the so-called carrying capacity of the world in terms of can we live on our planet without damaging it? So it kind of the question really is, you know, how many people can live on Earth? How can they live? And how can they do that without damaging the rest of the world and future generations? In that sense, that's kind of what the word sustainability is all about. How can we live now in a way that doesn't compromise the livelihoods and security and health of other people in the world or that of future generations? And unfortunately, right now, the way we do live even today is compromising the way people live around the world and our ecosystems and other species in the world, as well as future generations for many, many years to come.
Mm-hmm. It does seem that from time to time, the answer to that question, that is, you know, what's the carrying capacity, or are we there, or have we exceeded it? It seems that we go back and forth between, there would have been a time when perhaps people couldn't hardly even imagine the idea of exceeding the capacity, then to the point where people were making very serious predictions about the fact that we were almost at that point,
yep,
and things would be very bad. And it seems that we sort of go back and forth. I mean, why does it seem that answering? I know that it's a complicated thing, but just having a basic answer, why does it seem that we sort of go back and forth between saying it's nearly the end of the world and then saying, well, maybe it's not quite that bad, and then we say, well, no, maybe it's really even worse than we thought? Why do we seem to vacillate that way?
That's a really good question. I mean, I'm personally of the belief that, you know, we live in the most challenging time in human history in terms of our, you know, ability to sustain the way we live in the future, our relationship to the environment, even our relationship to each other. And this is a very, very complex and dangerous time. But also, I would argue it's the best time in human history to be alive. Think about the fact that, yes, we have problems with food and water and the environment and political instability and everything. But on the other hand, we have more people as a fraction of the human population who who have at least some food every day, who have access to some water every day, who have literacy, who have, you know, basic needs taken care of. There's still far too many people in the world who do go without. But compared to the rest of history, we're doing better in that regard than we ever have. I think the question here isn't, is the world getting worse or getting better, but is the world as good as it could be? Is it as good as we want? Is it the kind of world, you know, that we want to just run by default, or is there a better world that we can make for ourselves and for the future? And so, you know, I would rather reframe that, you know, this kind of question, is the glass is half full or half empty, but more, well, how can we fill up the glass? You know, how can we make the world better? And so I instead of polarizing this, you know, either the world is great or it's bad, it's just more of a question of, you know, where are we going with it?
Mm-hmm. Well, let's focus on a couple of things. I'm going to ask about one thing specifically. Let's look at, for example, the capacity of the Earth to produce food. That is, can we feed everybody? And if we're expecting that the population will increase, can we meet that increase? And take a look at how much land is in production now, how much productive land we have. What is the capacity of the Earth to just simply to feed all of its people?
Well, you know, amazingly, we use an enormous amount of land for agriculture. A lot of people think about land use in the world, and they think about, you know, Walmarts and sprawl and that kind of thing. But by far and away, the most amount of land we use in the world for anything is to grow food. We use about 18 million square kilometers of land, or in other words, that's about the size of South America, to put that in perspective. That's the amount of farmland in the world, places like Illinois and Wisconsin, for example, but everywhere in the world, growing corn and rice and wheat and everything like that. We use about 35 million square kilometers, or that's about the size of Africa put all together, as grazing land and pastures to basically raise cows and goats and stuff like that all over the world. So that's a huge amount of real estate devoted to agriculture. And we already have used most of the world's best farming lands. There really isn't much left in terms of ripe agricultural frontiers. So any additional area we use to grow food is going to be in pretty marginal places that aren't so good for agriculture, or they might come at the expense of very important ecosystems like the tropical rainforest, for example. So the trick is not to expand the amount of land we're using, though we are doing that in some places, especially the tropics, but we've increased dramatically how much food we grow per acre, mainly by using more chemicals. We've drastically increased the number of chemical fertilizers used in the planet in the last few decades, also through irrigation. And both of those things, using fertilizers and irrigation, come at a huge environmental cost. You know, when we put fertilizers on our farms or, heck, even in our gardens, it doesn't seem like it's a bad thing. It seems like, hey, the plants are growing better. But those fertilizers don't stay put. They get in our groundwater, causing serious problems with nitrate pollution, for example. They can cause blue baby syndrome if it's too much nitrate in your drinking water. Or it can get into our ecosystems, our lakes, our rivers, and even into the oceans. Right now in the Gulf of Mexico, for example, there's a huge dead zone, an area where fish can no longer literally breathe. They can't actually survive in the oceans anymore in this dead zone off the coast of Gulf of Mexico, largely because of the fertilizers we here in the upper Midwest dump into the Mississippi River. So there are huge environmental costs associated with growing all this food. But I'm not fearful that, you know, we can grow more food. We're growing a huge amount now. We can feed the world's population. I think we can feed it for many decades to come. But the question is, at what environmental cost, at what social cost, and so on? You know, do we want everything in the world to look like Iowa or central Illinois? Well, maybe it's okay in Illinois, but do you want the rainforest to look like that? Do you want the oceans to be devastated by excess pollution and runoff? Do we want our groundwater to be polluted everywhere in the world? So there's a trade-off here between kind of this industrial agriculture we sort of need in some ways, but also the state of the environment and the state of our health.
Let me ask you then another basic question here about another basic requirement, and that is water, access to water.
Yeah.
You need it for agriculture. You also need it to live. And here it's something that I think we're becoming increasingly aware that demand on the water supply is increasing, and we expect it to increase, and that this we could indeed have very serious problems with availability of water in the future.
Yes, that is a serious issue. at least in some regions of the world, water, the amount of water is already becoming a severe problem. As you mentioned before, the huge amount of water used for irrigation, roughly 85% of the water consumed in the world is actually consumed by agriculture and irrigation. Not everywhere, but globally averaged. And a relatively small amount is used for people. But that amount that's used for people not only has to be available, it has to be available all the time, and it has to be clean, it has to be safe. And many of the world's people, billions of the world's people, do not have access to regular, available, safe, clean drinking water. That is a huge problem in the world. It's one of the biggest health burdens still on the planet. Here in the U.S., we have the luxury of turning on the tap and having, most of the time anyway, safe drinking water. But again, many people in the world, especially the world's poorest people, are very, very lucky to get to clean drinking water when they can. Most of the time, they cannot. And I believe this is one of the biggest health problems on the planet, even though it doesn't get the same amount of attention as other health problems.
You know, I think, you know, whatever we on this program had this kind of conversation, it seems that sooner or later someone calls in and says, well, you know, the problem here is population. What this really is, what we're talking about here, is a demographic problem.
Yeah.
And that is that the Earth, we should think that there is some sort of optimum number of people that the Earth can support. There's only so many people you can feed. There's only so much water. You have to deal with the waste. You have to deal with the energy demand. And that ultimately the solution to these kinds of problems or other things that we might talk about when you're talking about the impact of population on the global environment, the ultimate solution is population control. Now, I'm inclined to think it's maybe not quite so simple as that, but some people want to say that's really your bottom line issue. How do you think about that?
I really respectfully disagree with that opinion. I think it hides a lot of other very important things. Now, first, yes, clearly the number of people in the world is an issue dealing with the environment. No question about that. We are now at 6.5 billion. We are projected to top out sometime by the middle of the century at maybe 9 billion. Now, if you went back 10 years ago or 20 years ago or 30 years ago, we were projecting things like 12, 15 billion, maybe even 20. So we have put the brakes on population growth around the world already, voluntarily. We don't need to, you know, have a draconian population control program, I don't think. As countries get more and more developed, as women have access to better health care and better education, we see naturally a transition from large families with low life expectancies to small families and longer life expectancies. That's just sort of a natural so-called demographic transition, and it's already happening. But what's interesting is in the last 50 years or so, the human population more than doubled. That is astonishing. We've more than doubled all previous history of population growth in just the last 50 years or so. That's already an amazing fact. But the world's economy, in terms of our use of goods and services, the stuff we buy, the stuff we trade, the flow of materials and services all over the world, that increased by sevenfold in the same amount of time. So, yeah, the population of the world is increasing, but the amount of stuff we use, the services we demand, the materials we buy, and so on, is increasing far, far faster than that. So it isn't just population. It is clearly consumption of resources and an inefficient use of resources and the waste associated with that. That's growing far more. And there, we don't see any breaks on that. When we see countries moving into a more consumer-oriented culture, like the United States, for example, but other countries too, there doesn't seem to be anything that prevents it from growing even more. To put it bluntly, you know, the more stuff we buy, the more stuff we want. Our resource consumption seems to continue to grow exponentially, while population grows exponentially for a while and then levels off. So I think, anyway, that population is a serious issue, but it is not the only issue, and I don't even think it's the central issue.
Yeah, it seems to me that is a very important point, and maybe something that people don't think about as much as they should. It is certainly true that there are many people around the world, places around the world, that have a very difficult time meeting their basic needs.
Yes.
On the other hand, you have to acknowledge the fact that then in another part of the world, growing prosperity might indeed be, it is, a global environmental issue.
Well, and it's an ethical issue, too. I mean, you know, in the United States, we have, what now, 300 million people who live, by and large, pretty well. Not everybody, but, you know, overall, we do pretty well. But us 300 million Americans, we could not live as well as we do if it weren't for the fact we basically take resources from other parts of the world. If we had to depend only on the resources of the United States territory, like, you know, for our energy, our food, even some of our water, we wouldn't be able to live as well as we do. So a lot of these environmental and resource problems around the world are not just due to people living where they do, but it's due to things like trade and where things go. So, you know, for us in the United States to be pointing fingers at countries that are very, very poor and say, oh, it's your fault that you're having this problem, it's your population, we have to look at ourselves in the mirror and say, wait a minute, we use, for example, five times the global average energy consumption of the world. We use something like, I forget the latest figure, but it's something like 60 to 70 times the resource consumption of the average person in India or Bangladesh. So again, you know, these numbers change every year, but, you know, Americans and Western Europeans and so on, we use an enormous amount of the world's resources, far more than our share if we divided it up 6 billion ways. And, you know, for us to then kind of be so high and mighty about that and then to point fingers at especially very poor people in the world and say, well, it's because you guys are having too many kids, that's ridiculous. I mean, and that's very unfair, and it's clearly not going to be listened to, and for good reason. Now, on the other hand, we cannot ignore that population is still part of the mix, but as I said before, it is naturally stabilizing in many parts of the world, and dealing with family planning and population control issues, you're talking about basic human rights, about, you know, the most fundamental of all human rights, that is, you know, should I have children and what I do about that. And I think that's a pretty tricky territory for people to be pointing fingers in.
We have several callers, and we'll get right to them in a moment. I do want to, though, introduce again our guest for anyone who might have tuned in the last few minutes. John Foley is the director of the Center for Sustainability and the Global Environment at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. There he is also the Gaylord Nelson Distinguished Professor of Environmental Studies and Atmospheric and Oceanic Studies. He is, by his academic training, an atmospheric scientist, as his Ph.D. in atmospheric sciences there from University of Wisconsin, Madison. We're talking about the issue of global environment and the big sustainability question. Questions are certainly welcome. We have several ready to go. We just, again, ask people to try to be brief so we can keep moving along. But all questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We'll start out with someone in Charleston. This is line number 4. Hello.
Yes, good program, David. I have a question and a comment. I recently heard about the potable water, that 1/7 of the water on the earth is potable as compared to the salt water. Is that accurate?
It's actually far less than that. It's something like
1%. Oh, okay. Well, it's gotten worse.
Yeah. No. Just the oceans are really, really big. I mean, the amount of fresh water in lakes, rivers, streams, and groundwater, I'd have to check the latest numbers on this, but it's something less than 1%.
Well, in any case, it is not just out there waiting to be used. And my comment is, under the now existing social paradigms that constitute the nuclear family, which is a squeeze away from the communal family and other sorts of tribalism, and the congregation of people, and the nuclear family organized under capitalist hegemony is wreaking the destruction, I think, that you are trying to articulate. I mean, if we think that we can support 9 billion people under the nuclear family, and that braced under capitalism, and suddenly 300 billion people plus Western Europeans who constitute Western ideals are already consuming probably 50% of the world's goods, and they can somehow continue that even up to 5 billion people living that way. There, the surface of the earth is going to be covered in asphalt and roads. And how there is no way that paradigm, organized as it is, under the capitalism, that this is sustainable. I mean, it is a raucous situation that has got to be addressed. And thanks, and I'll hang up and listen.
All right. Well, first of all, you can address that any way you like.
Well, I mean, that's a very interesting comment. It goes, you know, into the heart of a lot of these issues. You know, I agree with a bit of what he said. On other bits, I don't, I think. But again, this, you know, I think the point that we would both say, though, is that sustainability is a challenge not only to things like population and the economy, but also how we kind of imagine the way we live. That a, you know, a culture that only consumes and consumes and consumes and doesn't consider the consequences of doing so will ultimately run into trouble. I think that's something we'd both agree on. But whether or not that's the only way we could run a society that is, you know, based on capitalism or other economic models, I don't think that's necessarily true. I think we can be smarter about this and find solutions that are actually very, very helpful along the way, and I think we're beginning to see signs for that now.
All right, let's talk next with a caller in Urbana. This is line number one. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. I have a couple of questions. The first is, it seems that as Western nations, their birth rates declining, we're having more immigration from other countries in order to sustain the kind of economic growth that the Western countries and developed countries would like to continue to have. And so as we have more people coming in, then those people become bigger consumers too. And it seems that this is almost a necessity of not only keeping the economy going, but also keeping programs like Social Security and the generous retirement programs that are available in most European countries going over time. So I was hoping you could address that. And then the other thing is, I was wondering if you could discuss the way that people eat and the effect that that has on the environment. The more that I've learned over the years, it seems like we really should be eating much less meat, not only for health reasons, but also for environmental reasons, and also fewer dairy products. And I don't think that this is something that most people really think about too much. We think more about driving our cars less and things like that. But I was hoping you could address those two topics, and I'll hang up and listen offline.
Okay. Wow. some great questions here. Well, I guess the first one I'll try to address more briefly, but the question about, you know, as countries like even the United States, but especially in Western Europe, we see that, you know, birth rates have declined to the point where if it weren't due to immigration, a lot of countries in Western Europe especially would be kind of losing population. I think, you know, Denmark, Norway, Sweden, and others, for example. But because those are, you know, pretty nice places to live and their economies are strong and sometimes there are jobs there, that they do see immigration like we do in the U.S. Now, the question is, a country that didn't have, you know, isn't necessary to have immigration to kind of continue the economic development and growth of a country. Well, that's an interesting question. It certainly would be difficult for a country that's losing its population, especially its young people. And that's something you're seeing in some Eastern European countries, for example. So, yeah, that's an interesting point. But getting to the second question, which I know a bit more about, I suppose. The question of diet. You know, when it comes right down to it, the two most important things we do with the environment is basically how do we use energy and how do we eat. All the stuff we do for recycling and cutting down, you know, this and that and, you know, whatever, that's really kind of small stuff compared to what do you eat and how do you consume energy. Those are the two elephants in the room in terms of how we deal with the environment. So in terms of diet, clearly, what we choose to eat has a big influence on the kind of land that's needed to grow that food, how it's grown, and so on. And I think everybody sort of knows from basic, you know, biology courses or whatnot that eating meat is much less efficient than eating, you know, just a vegetarian diet in terms of the amount of land and energy that's needed to grow that stuff. Nevertheless, you know, I still eat meat personally. I don't eat a lot of it, but I eat some. And, you know, I'd be the last person in the world to try to tell everybody they should just, you know, become vegans and eat tofu by candlelight in a cave someplace. You know, I'm not going to push a lifestyle on anybody. I don't think anybody likes to have that done to them. But on the other hand, you know, maybe we should be thinking for our own health reasons and for our economy. And, oh, yeah, also for the environment. Perhaps diet a little less of meat in it, kind of like our grandparents used to eat meat only once in a while. Maybe that's something we should be thinking about. But again, I think when environmentalists tend to push an agenda like that, it falls on deaf ears sometimes. Maybe we need a more friendly and accessible way to do that by just telling folks, you know, hey, maybe listen to your doctor first and then think about the environment and see what you can do. But, you know, meat production is going to be a reality in the world. Maybe we can just do it a little more efficiently and maybe not such a big demand of it.
It seems that, we, though, are at a difficult point here where it, where we're saying that the kind of the level of energy consumption and waste production and the impact of human beings on the global environment is getting to the point where we have to say it may be we're at the point already where we would say it's not sustainable. If not now, then soon we're going to say it's not sustainable. So a couple of things, we run up against a couple of big problems. One is that for people in the developed world, places like Europe and the United States and maybe also some places in East Asia, we're having to say to them or to ourselves, maybe we should think about scaling back and living a little bit differently. That's sort of one big set of issues. And then there's another when you have to say to people in the developing world who aspire to have the standard of living of United States and Western Europe, you have to say to them, you know, you just can't do this. We can't. Everybody in China cannot live like your average American. It just can't. The earth just can't take it. How do you approach it's, you know, it's one thing to say to people who already have it, maybe you're going to have a little bit less. It's another thing to say to people who really want it to say, maybe you want it, but you can't have it.
Well, I think you're touching on, you know, what a lot of folks I think would call the great myth of our time is that somehow using more stuff and, you know, using more resources and creating more waste is somehow good for the economy and good for human well-being. It's not. There's a huge difference between economic growth, the growth of the stuff we use, the resources we consume, and the crap we make, and the stuff we throw away, and economic and social development. That is, you know, are people better off? Do they have better health care? Do they have more time with their family? Are they more secure? Are they able to live a meaningful life that they want? Those are not necessarily the same thing at all. So if we can really get, you know, basically our leaders and our even our economists, I think, frankly, to figure out that, you know, economic growth measured in terms of the amount of junk that we use and throw away, that isn't the same thing as actually developing a better world. Then we've made some real progress. For example, you know, when we buy gasoline, none of us want gasoline, right? You know, why the hell do we want gasoline for? What we want is to get from point A to point B, right? So if we could imagine ways of getting people from point A to point B conveniently, safely, and hopefully in a more sustainable way, people would go for it. We have all these, you know, technological solutions to do the same things we do today or better that use fewer resources, that create much fewer waste. So, I really don't think that we have to, you know, think in this kind of sacrifice mode, like we have to give up meaningful things in our lives, like the ability to get around, the ability to have a good meal, the ability to have good health care and be with our families and have a decent quality of life. I don't think we have to give up any of that to be on a more sustainable trajectory. In fact, I think by moving to a more environmentally sustainable trajectory, using fewer raw materials and producing fewer waste, in fact, we're going to improve dramatically our quality of life. It's going to be better than it is now, and I think it's going to be a hell of a lot of fun, to be honest. These are all things that are good for us. These are things that are beneficial to our local economy, that are good for our health care, are good for our environment as well. So, you know, we've got to just stop, you know, believing that buying more stuff, throwing away more stuff, and using more junk is somehow good for us, because it's not. There's no question about it, but it is sort of the big myth out there that somehow that, you know, resource consumption and waste equals prosperity. It doesn't.
All right, let's talk with some other callers. Next is someone listening in Champaign, and this is line number two. Hello.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, that segues perfectly into what I was going to bring up. You may be familiar with the book Natural Capitalism by Paul Hawkins and Avery and Hunter Lovins, and this is exactly what they're talking about. And go in great detail about a lot of very practical, pragmatic things that could be done that would improve not only the economy, but, you know, have a much more light footprint on the earth. But one of the many in over 300 pages here, suggestions that they put forth that I think is very good, a practical step to moving to a radical resource productivity would be a shift in our tax structure away from taxing labor and income and towards taxing pollution, waste, carbon fuels, and resource exploitation, which are all presently subsidized. And people, I don't, you know, really understand or realize that a lot of these things are highly subsidized. And for every dollar the taxation that's added to the cost of the resources you could take and waste, you could take a dollar and remove it from the taxes we currently put on labor and capital formation.
Yeah, that's an interesting idea. I mean, it's a little out there for the current, economic landscape or political landscape we have in the country right now. But, yeah, try to imagine a country where, let's say you go to work in the morning. You're doing something good for society, right? You're doing your job. You're providing a service. You're making goods. You're doing things that are helpful. And yet you're being kind of penalized by taxes for doing it. Instead, if taxes were instead, as Paul Hawken and others have been advocating, if you had tax structures instead penalize not the good things we do, like working and doing a job, but instead penalize things like the waste we produce, the things that we do inefficiently, and kind of create an incentive instead of, taxing the good stuff we do, tax the bad things we do. And that would create the right kind of incentive structure. And it might be, financially and politically neutral in theory. I don't think our current, just as a regular citizen, not an expert on this, but I can't imagine our current political landscape really moving in that direction right away. That'd be kind of different. But you can imagine some baby steps along the way, right? Things that might make sense, for example, giving people incentives to do things like, we have incentives now to buy more efficient vehicles, like hybrid cars get a tax credit. Now, of course, the federal government still subsidizes oil and gas exploration, the wealthiest country companies, that is, on the planet, who've been doing really well. Why do they need our tax dollars to go look for more oil? I think they ought to be able to do that themselves. And maybe that money could instead be redirected into things like figuring out how to make ethanol work in the Midwest, help farmers here in the Midwest, for example, or wind power or solar technology, things that are kind of keeping money at home, producing jobs in the heartland of America that are making us more energy independent, less reliant on foreign sources of oil, et cetera. So I think, we have to ask some hard questions about our current tax incentives and subsidy structures. Energy, transportation, agriculture, these are all very heavily subsidized and not always in ways that are really in line with what we should have, I think, as long-term goals for health, security, the war on terror, as well as on the environment. Maybe we could do what we do already a lot smarter.
Well, of course, there'll be a lot of pushback from, the powers that be that are currently highly subsidized. And I mean, just look at the whole thing with having wars and a Pentagon budget that is so enormous is all about putting money in the pockets of the people who own Martin Marietta and Bechtel and Halliburton, and so far they've been able to impose their will on us, but that may be changing.
That's your opinion. I mean, I know a lot of folks who share that, but a lot who don't. But I think, the broader point here would be that, last time I checked, the special interest in America was still the voters. And if we, do a good, intelligent kind of look at these things about saying, is this where we as a country want to put our priorities and our money, then hopefully we can begin to change that. But, it's fairly easy to be cynical about that these days. But, I guess I'd like to be an optimist about that.
All right, let's talk next with someone in Belgium nearby. Line number three, hello.
Good morning, sirs. Mm-hmm. It seems one of the words you said a few minutes ago really comes down to the basis of the problems. We want a certain quality of life. We expect it. We've been told by all types of media, from written to television, whatever, mm-hmm. radio. All of us are guilty of wanting something more and more, and that seems to be the true basis of this. Everybody wants a little bit more. I want a little more money. I want a little nicer place to live. I want a nicer couch to sleep on or whatever. And it seems that's where the basis of the problem is. And if we started just propagandizing ourselves, shall I use that word, to we can live very well, but we don't have to live so rich, if you know what I mean. And that, because other countries do it quite well and limit the growth in certain areas. It's really stupid around these major Midwestern towns and cities to consume property that would be great for growing the crops that you want to save, but yeah, we'll put a McMansion house on top of it and fill it clear full of worldly goods. And for what? Just to keep one, two, maybe three people happy? Makes you kind of wonder, doesn't it?
Well, it's an interesting point of view. I mean, I think, well, I mean, I guess the problem, I mean, I agree with many of the things you're saying there that, you know, as a scientist, I would say that, or, you know, somebody who works on these issues that, you know, one of the big problems is that as human aspirations, as, you know, people want different, you know, increasingly rich lives, if you will, that maybe we've misplaced what it is that really makes us happy and what, you know, what it is that really makes us have a high quality of life. Is it the stuff we buy, or is it the time we get to spend it with our family? Is it, you know, the time that we are healthy and able to do what we want? Is it the time we get to enjoy with others? Or is it, you know, going to the mall and buying more stuff? I don't know. But, you know, I'd like to think that when we look at other places around the world that we see other models where people have a very rich quality of life and they have time to spend with each other and they have wonderful meals together, they get to go out, they get to travel and so on, but maybe use a little bit less stuff than we do in America. So I think there are some models there to consider. But on the other hand, I think oftentimes, and I'm not saying this caller was going there, but I oftentimes think environmentalists do sound a little preachy about, you know, well, we all have to change the way we think about the way we live. And, you know, I don't mind at all if people want to have a really great, you know, home entertainment system. I just think it ought to be 50% more efficient than the one sold last year. I don't think it's a problem at all if people want to have a big car, but I think it ought to be, you know, completely sustainable and get 300 miles to the gallon if possible, something like that. Why not? If you want to drive a living room out on the highway, let's do it, but let's do it in the most technologically advanced way we know how to do it. And not just improve people's material possessions, but at the same time, if people really want to buy more stuff, let's do it in a way that not only gives you more material well-being, but more environmental well-being, more health well-being, more social well-being at the same time. And right now we're kind of buying more stuff, but we're kind of hurting ourselves in so many other ways. We're, you know, really degrading our own environment, our own health, our own security, at the expense of just getting more toys. Hmm. And, you know, we all like toys, but can we do that in a way that's a lot more thoughtful, a lot more, you know, sustainable, and hopefully a lot more compassionate in the long run?
It seems that often in these kind of conversations that we end up with two kind of camps that aren't necessarily opposed, but people who sort of the argument on one side is that whatever problems we have that technology has caused, technology can fix. The other side being people say, no, you know, that's not going to do it. We can't really solve these kinds of environmental problems by attacking it with more technology because that was the problem in the first place. What we have to do is actually change the way we think, and then that in turn changes the way we live. And it seems that, as I say, often in these conversations that seems to be as presented as a choice between one, yeah. You either have to do one or the other thing, and that it seems to be mutually exclusive somehow.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up because I totally agree that this polarization of, you know, it's the technological fix, or no, we have to have radical new social norms. The answer there, of course, is yes. We need to think about both of those. On the technology side, I mean, yeah, I get a little bit annoyed with some of my environmental friends who, you know, really venomously attack modern technology. And I look at them and say, how old are you? Oh, 40. Well, the only reason you're alive today is because of technology. I mean, you know, we have so many things to be thankful for: our life expectancies, our health, our many of the things, you know, the wonders of technology. I mean, the fact that we're on the telephone and broadcasting radios, and maybe, I don't know if you're doing podcasting as well here, but
yes.
Yeah, so, you know, all those things are amazing. You know, there are 1.5 billion, with a B, billion people on the world today using the internet regularly. That's a quarter of the human population talking to each other without anybody really minding what we say. That's incredible. So we live in an amazing technological era where there are, you know, huge, huge benefits. Technology wins, you know, overwhelmingly on a positive side. There are some very negative things too, but overwhelmingly it's been very positive. But does that mean we can't also think about our responsibilities with these technologies to, you know, use them more wisely in a more sustainable and healthy way in the long run? Of course, naturally. Whether it's the way we use energy, the way we grow food, can we do those things more sustainably, or all the way to things like, you know, how we use biotechnology, how we use even things that could be weapons and so on. So again, I think you raised a very good point here that, you know, I personally believe our society will be better off with technological advance, but also a much more respectful and thoughtful, you know, kind of discussion as a society about how we use technology wisely.
Our guest is John Foley. He's director of the Center for Sustainability and the Global Environment at the University of Wisconsin, where he is also the Gaylord Nelson Distinguished Professor of Environmental Studies and Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. And questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We'll continue, and next we'll talk with someone in Kankakee, and this is toll-free line 4. Hello.
Your caller is pleased to hear a reference to Hawkins and the Lovins' natural capitalism and has three questions, if you might. One, how does the guest respond to assertions such as those of urbanologist Jane Jacobs relating to the preeminence of cities in the agriculture and urban development balance wherein cities drive agriculture? And two, how does the guest respond to the optimism of population scientists such as Dr. Jonas E. Salk, which tend to regard a large population of the Earth by mankind, even a population of 11 billion people, as a positive thing, in that with such a population there will be a transformation of consciousness which will make possible a new synthesis under which it will be possible to solve our current problems? And three, how does the guest respond to the omnivore's dilemma, Michael Pollan's book, which might tend to suggest that natural sustainable food production is superior to industrial agribusiness? Thank you.
Wow, that's a lot. That's the problem. We have about 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Maybe you can, if you want to concentrate on maybe one or two of those things, you can deal with it as you like.
Okay. Maybe I'll deal with the last question. The caller was referring to this book called Omnivore's Dilemma, but it, you know, which is represents actually a larger body of thought by many people, not just one author there. But the idea that you know, somehow we have to choose between kind of, you know, industrialized agriculture, the way we tend to farm now, which is, you know, very fertilizer-intensive, very machinery-intensive, very water-intensive, and so on. And I would argue, and I think many others would argue, is, you know, completely unsustainable in the long run, the way we farm, even here in the Midwest. And I know some of your listeners are farmers, and I deeply respect anybody who works on the land. But, you know, everyone has got to think that, you know, the way we use farming systems today that causes pollution of our groundwater, that causes the destruction of fisheries in the Gulf of Mexico, for example, that can't be good in the long run. That can't be completely sustained forever and ever and ever. So we know that something's not right there. But the economics and policy structures we live in, that's what most people do. However, you know, the argument is that, well, that's the only way to do agriculture, or you could do this kind of fringe, funny, you know, organic stuff, but, you know, yeah, that doesn't produce enough food and it's too expensive. Well, that's where Omnivore's Dilemma and other works recently have actually tried to challenge that assumption, suggesting that actually more sustainable agricultural models are, in fact, more productive than industrialized agriculture. They actually can be very, very productive. They can be much more profitable to farmers here in the Midwest, for example, and that's definitely true. And it also might be, you know, a very good way to, you know, go back to the way our grandfathers used to farm, and but with more, you know, maybe a blend of some technology and some other things, not giving up all the advances of more modern agriculture, but to be a little more thoughtful about it. You know, do we really want to do this sort of intensive farming everywhere? That's really a good question. So I guess responding to that, I think that's a very interesting point. I think we need a lot more experimentation, a lot more varieties of how we farm, and learning different ways to do it. You certainly see a lot of success in these new kinds of agricultural techniques that are really kind of bringing back the old ways.
Well, again, I thank the caller for his questions. We don't have a lot of time left. I'd like to try to get at least one more. We'll see if we can
sure.
do more than that, but at least one. The next person in line is in or here in Urbana, where we are, line one. Hello?
Good morning, Professor Foley.
Hi.
It's a big question, and there's not much time to answer. Let me put it briefly. there's a contradiction between the second law of thermodynamics, the law of entropy, and middle-class values, which basically stated is serve yourself and screw your buddy, the automobile society. I can only refer the other listeners to James Howard Kunstler's The Long Emergency, Surviving the Converging Catastrophes of the 21st Century. David has already interviewed him. And do you have a plan for resolving that contradiction? Thank you for taking my call.
Wow, your listeners really asking me questions here. gosh, that's another one where it'll take an hour to answer. But I think you know, the short version here is that, you know, the caller raises an interesting point that that, I mean, to put it more simply, I suppose, is to say that a lot of the things we do as a society are inherently unsustainable. They use more resources than nature puts back. They are not really thermodynamically or in any other way kind of truly sustainable in the long run. And so we, in the next, well, this not just some distant future, but right now and through the coming century, will be coming to grips with the consequences of those decisions, how we decide to live and how we basically do so on a finite planet.
Let's try and do at least one more, then. We'll go to line three. This is also Urbana. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
Am I on?
Yes, go ahead.
My question is similar to the earlier caller's. My biggest concern, and I certainly agree with everything you're saying, and I compliment your guest and your radio show for having this kind of discussion, but my biggest problem with it is that I'm afraid the American public in general is just too complacent. And the only way we will ever change is when we're sitting in our living room in the dark with our heaviest coat on, because we can't afford electricity and we can't afford heat. And I guess what makes me feel even stronger towards this is last summer when gasoline was approaching $2.80 a gallon, $3 a gallon, nobody changed their driving habits, and I see as many SUVs and pickup trucks sucking gas down as we've ever seen. And I'm just so concerned that when we wake up, it's going to be too late. And I'd appreciate it if your guests could comment on some of those observations.
All right. Well, thanks for the call again. Well, Professor Foley?
Yeah, well, again, that raises a very interesting point that, yeah, we... I think, like anybody, I don't like to pick on Americans. I think we are an amazingly adaptable and innovative country. We are the country that, you know, basically defeated fascism and, you know, two continents at the same time in World War II. We put people on the moon. We, you know, fought the civil rights battle. We, you know, women's suffrage. We ended slavery. I mean, this country has done so many amazing things when they had vision, leadership, and a real challenge. We certainly have the challenge. I think everyone in the country, at least to some degree or another, is conscious that we are facing an enormous societal and environmental challenge right now, whether it be global warming or food security or water. I think that's permeating our culture well enough now. And what we really seem to be lacking, frankly, is kind of the leadership, not just at the national level, but everywhere, that we need to really challenge ourselves. And maybe it's, you know, we need another kind of civil rights era with people like Martin Luther King and others really forcing us to look hard in the mirror and ask ourselves, is this the country we want? Is this the way we want to live? And is this the world we want to leave our children? I think when we're faced with those realities, this country, more than almost any other, can really rise to the challenge and make the world a better place. And I look forward to seeing that happen, and I wish for that every day.
Well, then, this is a good place for us to finish, and finish we must, because we have maybe about a minute. Whenever we have conversations about these kind of big issues, it is very clear that a lot of people are deeply pessimistic and doubt our ability to meet the challenge. Do you find some reason to be optimistic about our ability to meet the challenge?
Well, I mean, you know, you can't be in the kind of business I'm in and every day seeing the reports of what's happening around the world and not be have a bit of a pessimistic side. But overall, I'm a deeply optimistic person. I know while we have, again, I think the greatest challenges humanity's ever faced in terms of our environment or the sustainability of our planet and even how we live with each other in a safe and sane way, we face enormous challenges like that now. But we also have enormous abilities to solve these problems, not just in our technology and amazing kind of ability to communicate, but innately in our culture and our inventiveness, our kind of, you know, incredible tenacity we have, not only as Americans, but as citizens of this planet. I am actually deeply, deeply hopeful that the world at the end of this century will be better than the world we have now, but only and only if we get off our butts and really do something about this. As Robert Wilson, who just died yesterday, said once, the future is up for grabs. It belongs to any and all who will take the risk and accept the responsibility of consciously creating the future we want.
That's a good thought to first end on, and we must. Our guest again, John Foley, is director of the Center for Sustainability and the Global Environment at University of Wisconsin, where he is also Gaylord Nelson Distinguished Professor of Environmental Studies and Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. And Professor Foley, thank you very much.
Well, thank you for having me on. It was a really enjoyable hour.